This is a Hot Pie original.
The Meyer Chronicles, take one. Welcome to The Meyer Chronicles, a Hot Pie Media production. For more information about The Meyer Chronicles, go to hotpiemedia.com. In this episode, John and Andy take it back to the 60s, to Andy's time promoting concerts during his high school and college years.
Hi, everyone. My name is Andy Meyer. Welcome to The Meyer Chronicles. This is one of my favorite podcasts because it's a throwback podcast way back. And I'm doing it with my good friend, John Rubin. Hi, John.
Hey, Andy. It's great to see you again. Great to be doing another podcast with you. You know, we've done a few podcasts on the making of some classic films that you've executive produced and were instrumental in creating. Among them are The Breakfast Club from John Hughes and Fried Green Tomatoes, which was nominated for an Oscar and a slew of other major awards. And we've done overall podcasts on your film years in the 80s and the 90s, all these great behind-the-scenes stories. And then we did a music podcast in the 70s, which had all these memorable anecdotes about stars you worked with at A&M Records, such as Joe Cocker, Cat Stevens, Cheech and Chong, the Sex Pistols even, and some guy named George Harrison. And today we're doing a throwback back to the 1960s. Before all that, during your high school and college years, which is technically when you first cut your teeth in the music business, even if you kind of didn't realize it. So take us back to the 1960s. You're a student at Harrison High School in the suburbs of New York City. What happened there that set you on a certain path?
Harrison High School is a public school with about 5,000 students at that time. And I was a student there. Nothing remarkable was happening to me until my senior year. And a letter from the high school was, I guess they handed it out in the classroom because there was no email. And the letter basically said, would you like to give $100 to the student scholarship fund? And my head exploded. It was the most important document I had ever received in my life. I was trying to get my own money together to go to college, and they were asking me to give them $100, and I didn't know if I would get any money back. And my philosophy of these things, which has stayed the same all my life, is if you want to ask somebody for something, give them either something back in return or give them a way to change the outcome. So, you know, if there's a problem, I tell this to all my students at SCAD in documentary film classes, for example. If you're doing a documentary about a cause, give somebody at the end a chance to help, or they just say, oh, here's a terrible cause. That's kind of depressing. So that night, I was in my room listening to my favorite band, the Blues Project. You know them, John.
Mm-hmm. You've turned me on to them. Yeah, I sure do. They were like a mix of blues, psychedelic rock, and yeah, jazz, a little R&B.
And they were huge in New York. So I'm looking at the album and I'm saying to myself, boy, it would be great if the Blues Project did a concert for the scholarship fund. We could make a ton more money than that stupid letter they passed around to me. And on those albums, in those days, they obviously don't do it anymore, there was the name of the manager and a phone number. So the next day after school, you know, after I'd done my homework, I'm in my parents' kitchen. And I remember the kitchen was like bright yellow with linoleum. It's like a 1950s kind of house. And on the wall, there's a rotary telephone. And I'm dialing the manager of the Blues Project in my parents' kitchen on a rotary phone. And the call goes something like this. His name was Dave. I said, hi, Dave, how much did the Blues Project charge for a concert? He said, $2,500. He asked me, when's the concert? I said, I don't know. He asked me, where's the concert? I said, I don't know. And I hung up.
Or he hung up.
Now, at least I knew what the Blues Project cost, and I had to find a venue. So I was driving around because there was no Google Maps then. And I sort of ran into the Westchester County Center, which is still there today and very active. There was a phone number. Called it up in my parents' rotary phone, and I found out what it cost. I now had a budget. I knew what the band cost, and I knew what the hall cost, and the county center seated 5,000 people, which I thought was fabulous. We could make a ton of money. So I went to the principal, and I said, let me promote the Blues Project, and I'll raise you a ton of scholarship money. He said, I don't know. There then started to be a whole bunch of I don't know meetings at Harrison High School about this, which ended up with me making a presentation to the Harrison High School Board of Education. And I gave them the budget and everything. And they asked me to play them a song. Now, This is 1967. You know, Woodstock's coming up in a year or two. Rock and roll is at its hottest. And the Blues Project were a really good band. I played the Board of Education, the sort of calmest song I could find, because I didn't know what these old people listened to. I thought maybe it was like Lawrence Welk or Perry Como or people like that. So they listened to the song and they actually approved the concert, which was pretty amazing in and of itself. And also I had an opening act because my brother was a really good trumpet player, had a jazz band, ended up playing with Miles Davis and Birdland. So I now had an opening act for free and we were off to the races and I promoted this concert and it was a huge success. And it made much more money than that letter ever would have.
Funny enough, they actually played the County Center the year before as an opening act for Chuck Berry, Muddy Waters, and Johnny Lee Hooker. But it was you who gave them headline status the year later. So you're talking to the School Board of Education. You're how old now? 16, maybe? It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I was 16, and I found out something else about that meeting a little later. Somebody slipped me the agenda for the meeting where I was presenting the project, and it was from a law firm who represented the Harrison High School Board of Education. And there was a list of items they were going to discuss. And John, you've seen this letter.
Yes.
Number four is the Andy Meyer problem.
It says, yeah, the letter says problems to be discussed. And you're one of them. Why did they view you or this concert as a problem as opposed to an opportunity?
I never found out the reasoning behind that. But, you know, it was unorthodox and I had never done it before. And, you know, it was money and it's a public high school. And I think they were just nervous, but it's just so funny to have it written as the Andy Meyer problem. It sounds like I'm a band.
Now, you didn't have to go out of pocket by a penny, right? They laid out all the money.
Oh, yeah.
You convinced them to lay out all the money, which is, again, from a 16-year-old kid. I think that's a very big deal. It's, you know, it's ballsy, as they say.
And they made a ton of money. So it was a huge success.
So the date is set. It's March 31st, 1967. You said something to me about you guys all got together, promotion, flyers, even went to radio stations to make this the concert that it became. Can you talk a little bit about how you promoted the show?
You know, it was really old school. Of course, then it wasn't old school. It was school. It was 53 years ago. But you know, you would go door to door with flyers and ask the store, you know, can we put this in your window? You'd go to the local radio station and hand them a promo. It was real grassroots. And because it was, you know, a rock and roll concert, a jazz concert, a lot of students got involved in the promotion after I set the thing up because they were motivated and it was for their scholarship fund. So they could actually relate to what the thing's about. It wasn't some sort of metaphysical, spiritual concept that they didn't understand. It was tuition that they'd be paying, you know, in 6 months. So it became a real kind of guerrilla promotion. And I think that's one reason why it was so successful. And my brother, who had just graduated from Harrison High School, was like the president of the class and everything. So everybody knew him and he was a big shot. And so I was happy to have him help me.
So what was it like that Monday after school, after the show? Everyone's coming off this high. You put together this amazing show for them. Did you feel a little bit like a hero or people patting your back?
I'll tell you the truth. I never thought it would fail because I knew the band. I knew my brother. I knew the facility. It was the real deal.
Yeah.
I just set it up and let it roll. And I knew everybody would be happy. From a content perspective, it wasn't risky at all. And once the Westchester County Center got involved, they do shows there every night. They're like a machine. So I felt good, but I never worried about it.
As I understand it, you would have never even ended up in Harrison or gone to Harrison High School or seen that, you know, letter about the scholarship fund if it weren't for your grandfather. Can you explain that connection?
That's an interesting segue from the Blues Project to my grandfather, but I can do it. I got to Harrison High School by misdirection. My family's claim to fame was that my grandfather invented the first woman's pajama called Tommy's. And my entire family worked for my grandfather. And we were doing very well. We were living upscale in Scarsdale, New York. Everybody was working in the garment industry. And my grandfather decided to sell the company to a public company. And the first thing the public company did was fire my entire family, including my grandfather, which meant my parents were out of a job. And so is everybody in the family. And so while I was living in Scarsdale. We had to literally move across the tracks to the other side of town. And then I ended up in Harrison High School, not knowing anybody. And that's what sort of got me there.
So sort of an unfortunate twist or sort of a little bit of a financial burden on your family led you to the place where you were able to start to gain some experience and, I guess, entrepreneurial experience on your own.
And by the way, one of the reasons why I was so upset about giving $100 to the high school scholarship fund is our budget was really tight. You know, we were really tight on money then and didn't know if we had money for me to go to college. And that's why my head exploded.
Listen, asking for $100 from a student in the late 60s, that would be the equivalent of about $500 or even $1,000 now. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But on the success of this concert, were you thinking at this point, okay, I'm going to be a concert promoter, or did you have more of a different career path in mind, perhaps?
That was sort of a one-off for me, and I enjoyed it. In terms of a career, my New York Jewish parents made it very clear I had three job choices. Pick one: lawyer, doctor, psychologist. There were no other jobs available to me except for those three jobs. And I even took a pre-law class as a freshman, and I said, that's a lot of work. And I dropped the class, so I knew I wasn't going to be a lawyer. I fainted at the sight of blood, so I knew I wasn't going to be a doctor. And I'm not that sensitive, so I knew I wasn't going to be a psychologist. So I said to myself, what do I like to do? And I said, well, I like to read books. I became an English major.
So now you're a freshman at Bucknell in the fall of 1967. I mean, what a year, what a time in our country's history to enter college, huh?
It was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, especially being a freshman just moving in there. You know, it was 1967. The anti-Vietnam War marches were going on. It was a crazy time to be a student.
What were your first couple of weeks like here, adjusting to life as a college student?
Oh, there was freshman orientation. And I wasn't thinking about the concert that I produced or anything. I was, you know, trying to get in the rhythm of what it was like to be in a new place in a new school. But I happened to see the schedule for the concerts that Bucknell had organized for the students. And it was like terrible. It was like a cellist, a violin concerto, an opera singer. It was all the music that the professors wanted to hear. And this was, you know, when my peers were listening to Jimi Hendrix and the Rolling Stones.
Sure.
And I thought it was awful. And then, this is where my head exploded again, I saw that there was a mandatory student activity fee, which was being charged to pay for these concerts. So whether you liked the bands or not, whether you went or not, you had to pay for these concerts. You know, I now had some experience in this, and I was still in touch with the manager of the Blues Project, and he had introduced me to some agents. And I started to do a little research. And, you know, I was living in New York, so I knew all about Bill Graham and the Fillmore East and their schedule of shows. And basically the way it works is that he had a season ticket system where you could buy tickets for all the concerts, and they were booked way in advance, and it was much cheaper than single tickets. And they were Friday, Saturday, and maybe Sunday. So I knew weeks and weeks in advance what bands were going to be at the Fillmore East, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And I said to myself, I wonder what they're doing on Thursday.
And what, Lewisburg is like a three-hour car trip from New York City?
It's like 3.5 hours. You can fly to Harrisburg, but Harrisburg is an hour from Bucknell. You know, Bucknell was 2,500 students. But I had this idea that if I could get the bands on a Thursday to play at Bucknell and then go into Manhattan and play at the Fillmore East, I could just model what Bill Graham was doing from Bucknell University. And I also had, and this was critical, we were 40 minutes away from Penn State, which is huge. And they didn't have a concert program. So I felt like my odds were a little better. The other big problem I had, there was only one place where you could have a concert, and that was the gym. It was called Davis Gym. And it was really small. And with chairs, it maybe 1,000 people could fit in there. And capacity is an interesting concept. If you have chairs, then you have an exact number of people who can go into the hall. If you don't have chairs, it's kind of an unlimited concept, because until you turn somebody away, you're keeping the capacity growing. So I said to myself, how can I increase the capacity? I threw all the chairs out, threw down a mat, called it festival seating, and could cram as many students in as I wanted, as long as I didn't turn them away.
And as long as you didn't tell the fire marshal.
Well, they got free tickets, so that, that was
fine. Always thinking, Andy, always thinking.
And I knew I could make some creative deals because the school just wanted their money back, and I could give a lot of the back end to the band. So that made it even more attractive. So I made a whole bunch of presentations to Bucknell, and they agreed to let me take over the entire college concert programming for the next year, which I did as a freshman.
Wow. So now you're 17. You've got this whole extra year of experience from high school. That's amazing.
I'm a veteran now.
Was somebody running this program before that you were essentially replacing, or you just stepped up and said, let me take care of this?
Well, there was some administrator who wasn't very good. I can say that now. It's 53 years later. But I thought to myself, if I'm going to run this, I ought to like have some sort of committee or something. I can't just like say, Andy Meyer wants you to do this. So I became the Bucknell Concert Committee. I went from student ID 7962 to the Bucknell Concert Committee. And I sent out things like, the Bucknell Concert Committee has decided we're going to do this. The Concert Committee voted to do that. So the students thought there were a lot of people involved, but it was just me.
That's awesome. Listen, presentation is half the reality, right?
Eventually, I brought more people in, but I was the Bucknell Concert Committee.
I assume the first couple of shows were probably smaller bands getting your feet wet. Was it a momentum thing where the first year or so were like mid-level bands and then bigger name bands started to know that Bucknell was kind of part of the concert route? Did you see a trend happening there?
No, I booked them volume booking through some agents. And the agents knew, one, the Penn State connection, two, that they were getting a better deal for me than just about anybody else, because we were kind of nonprofit. You know, we weren't doing it to make money. We were doing it to provide good music for the students. So, you know, depending on how well they did, they could make more. And it's a Thursday night, so it's an off night. And they're going into the Fillmore. So it worked out.
So with Penn State, you've got, what, 20, 30,000 kids that are like, what, a 40-minute drive from Bucknell, and you're tapping into that? That's really smart.
And there was no concert program there, and nobody doing the kind of things the Bucknell Concert Committee was doing.
So you're marketing heavily at Penn State, and those kids are happy to drive over. It's great.
Totally. And that's what makes a, you know, a little college of 2,500 students be able to bring in this kind of high-end talent. And everybody wondered why these bands were going to Bucknell. It was like, it became a thing. You're playing Bucknell before the Fillmore East. And it was because of Penn State.
So as the committee now, are the students still paying like a singular fee for the year, but they're going to get good concerts in return? Was that kind of how you set it up?
I gave them the option of buying tickets individually, which was more. Mm-hmm. But what happened is when they came to the next freshman orientation, you know, I had booked like the Grateful Dead or The Band and Donovan. I had booked all these great bands. And so everybody bought season tickets. So I got all my money back up front, which is important to be able to run the program. And it was more successful than, you know, these little silly individual concerts.
So I'm looking at the list of the biggest names here that have played Bucknell that you brought in as the head of the committee here. The Grateful Dead, the Beach Boys, Sly and the Family Stone, the Association, Judy Collins, who I know also played Monterey, probably right before or after she played Bucknell, Donovan, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. I mean, these are names that dominated the Billboard charts in 1966, 1967, and for a couple of years before that. The Band, Levon Helm, Robbie Robertson, Miles Davis. I mean, these are huge artists from this era, and they're all playing this little college, and you got them all here. That is quite a list right there. And it would not be rock and roll without stories to tell. There's got to be some stories about some of these bands. Can you give me a few highlights of bringing in some of these A-list bands to this little college?
Well, I have to start with the Grateful Dead because they almost destroyed my whole system. My system was designed on not having to turn anybody away. And then there would be no capacity problems, you know, with numbers. The Grateful Dead was an hour late, and all of Penn State came to Bucknell that night trying to get into the concert. And I was trying to calm people down and trying to cram as many people in as I could and to give more tickets away to the fire department so they'd let me do that. And I ended up on a ledge in the front of the venue with a bullhorn trying to calm the crowd down. And as I think about this, I said to myself, where'd I get a bullhorn? I mean, I didn't. I don't drive around with a bullhorn. I don't carry one in my trunk. How did I get a bullhorn? And I actually was able to get everybody in, but it was not a pretty picture. However, you know, it was a very intimate setting, let's just say.
You know, I'm not a deadhead by any stretch of the imagination, but true fans will actually tell you that that concert at Bucknell in the spring of 71, that's like a legendary tour for them. I guess The Working Man's Dead had just come out the year before. That particular show is considered one of the best performances, best sound quality bootlegs from that tour. And then like barely a week later, they're doing that legendary run at the Fillmore East. So there's your, we'll get you on a Thursday at our place before you head into the city. Something I noticed when I was reading some comments on that show from a dead fan page, a lot of people were really reveling in the fact that they were able to see such a big band in such a small venue. Like, that's a great opportunity you were able to provide for fans that normally wouldn't have access, right?
I think that it was like playing a club, like playing the Roxy or the Troubadour, but it's a small stadium and it's very intimate because everybody's, you know, crowded around the stage sitting, you know, looking up at the band. And it's about as close as anybody in those days could get to the Beach Boys or the Dead.
Right.
You know, or those big bands, you know. And also, it's a small town. It's a small college. The band mingled with people. They hung out afterwards, except for Miles Davis.
yeah, tell me about his show.
Well, he was great. And I had met him before, but he's got this shtick, which he loved, of turning his back to the audience and playing, which you could read all kinds of cultural implications into why he's doing that. But he seemed to have a good time, and it was a fantastic show. So I'm a big Miles Davis fan.
And I bet you have a few amazing stories about Sly and the Family Stone.
Well, Sly and the Family Stone were late. And just before they were going to go on, Sly, not his manager, comes up to me and says, I'm not going on unless you give me $2,500 in cash, which was his fee for the band. And I didn't have $2,500 in cash. I had whatever was in the box office. So I went to the president of the college's house during dinner and said, I need $2,500 in cash now. The concert was filled. The place was filled.
Right.
And they're waiting for me. And Sly won't go on until I bring him his money. So the college president goes to the president of the bank during dinner and says, we got to go to the bank and get $2,500 right now. Because there's like 4,000 people in Davis Gym. And they're waiting for this band to go on. And I don't know what's going to happen if they don't go on. So the president, the head of the bank, me, we're now, you know, we're like a gang. we're breaking into the bank, getting $2,500 in cash. I'm rushing it over to Sly, who's now over an hour late, and he goes on. But in fairness to Sly, he did me a favor, and I was grateful for that. And that sometimes if the bands had, you know, an extra day or so, I would invite them to go to the Lewisburg prison to perform because it was just good for everybody. And he said he would go. Of course, none of the women in the band could go to the prison because the male prisoners would have a heart attack. So it was just the guys going to the band. And I'm standing on the side of the stage and it's all going fine. And a man comes up to me and he said, I'm here. You're the guy who produces all these concerts. I said, I am. He handed me a card. He said, my name is Jimmy Hoffa. If you ever need anything, call this number. And it was Jimmy Hoffa.
If you ever need anything, call this number.
And, you know, I never called the number, but I always wondered what would have happened if I did. Maybe I'd be running the Lower East Side Mafia in Manhattan or something.
Or maybe you'd be buried under the Meadowlands. I think it's better that you didn't call.
Yeah. I didn't keep the card. I should have kept the card, but that was a great story. And, you know, speaking of money, one of the things that I ended up doing is, you know, at the end of every show, I was afraid to leave all that money at the gym, you know, in the box office. Right, somebody could break in. So I got this suitcase, poured all this cash into it like I was a mafia guy, and left the stadium with a suitcase filled with cash, drove to my house where I had three roommates who I think thought I was in the drug business because I was arriving, you know, every concert night with a suitcase full of cash. And I was so scared I would lose it. I literally put it under my bed and went to sleep and woke up the next morning and went to the bank. So the Bucknell Concert Committee put the suitcase under the bed and went to sleep.
And all his roommates thought that he was a drug dealer.
Yeah. Not anymore, I hope, but you know. Right. Then they did.
And so while you're doing all this, you're actually a student going to school at the same time. How are you pulling that off?
Well, by senior year, I really didn't have time for my classes. I went to one professor because I had an economics class. And I said to him, I really like your class, and I really liked him as a professor, but I said, I just don't have time. You know, I've got these two shows coming up, my last quarter. I don't want to drop your class. And he said, well, look, why don't you write an independent study? Because you're running a business. So write, you know, a paper for me on how you run the Bucknell Concert Committee. And I did it over Easter break in a week. I stayed up for like five nights. And I gave him a paper, which became sort of a manual for the next generation of students to know how to produce concerts. So it was called Dancing on the Seats. So, you know, when I graduated, I wanted to tell everything I knew to the freshmen who were coming in, who were taking over the program. That paper got sent around and ended up getting to Hollywood. And I had already been talking to people in the record business because they heard about all these concerts at this university called Bucknell. And they didn't know what was going on. And through that paper, I had it published. Billboard Publications published it as a book called Dancing on the Seats, which is one of the ways I connected to A&M Records and got a job as the director of college promotion the day I graduated, which is the subject of one of our other podcasts.
Yeah, that's very full circle right there. You mentioned that your professor said you're running a business. Did you feel like you were running a business? Did you realize yet you had already taken these big steps?
It was a business because I was dealing with a lot of managers and agents and money and the practicalities of producing an event. I knew it was a business and it had my attention. Let me just say that more than school. I'd hate to go back and look at my transcript. I'd rather look at billboards of who came to Bucknell than my transcript at Bucknell. But what I'm proud of is I created something that is still going now, 53 years later. There's a Bucknell Concert Committee that is booking bands right now, and I just saw their Facebook page. So to invent something that lasts that long, it's like my movies. It makes me feel good that most things come and go so quickly, you know, it's like fast food. But to have a system design that everybody's using all this time later, to have movies that people talk about, you know, like The Breakfast Club and Fried Green Tomatoes, I like it. And from the students' perspective, you know, over the years, I've been reading sort of a running commentary about how students enjoyed the concert series and how important it was to their lives and their experience at college and how memorable it was to be at the Grateful Dead that night. So the experience just wasn't something for me. It was for, you know, thousands of students who were in that venue that magical night for either the Beach Boys or the band. And I think that's the legacy of the program.
And listen, the college I went to brought in a lot of big bands as well and similar type of gym arena. And those are absolutely some of the biggest highlights of my 4 years there for sure. I can tell you every show I saw every day it was what band, but I don't really remember who my English professor was. So
no, but I think those experiences are what's most important about college.
Absolutely. So why did you want to do a podcast about these years?
I'll tell you why. And it's timely. I really believe that one person can make a difference. And I did in my own way, you know, not at a major scale. But I think some people have a feeling because of the pandemic and the kind of year we've had of being helpless or not being able to control their lives, not being able to leave their house, not be able to hang out with their friends. And I wanted to try and do something that might be uplifting, maybe get a laugh or two. There are some teachable moments in there. And I wanted to make a positive contribution to society. And I thought by telling my story of somebody who somewhere, you know, listens to it and feels empowered to do something, then I will have been successful in this story and in this podcast. And, you know, I'm an optimist. I root for everybody. And I just think this is a good time to tell some good stories and let people know that, you know, the future will be bright. I mean, it may take a little while to get there, but we're still going to have a bright future in this country. And I'm grateful for all that it's given to me. So I just want to pass along what I've learned.
I also feel like the lessons you've learned from sort of the beginning of your entrepreneurial career kind of served as a blueprint for some of the later successes you had. If none of any of this stuff we talked about today had happened, you know, maybe you don't get to A&M Records, you know, you don't start A&M Films. There is no Breakfast Club, God forbid. But, you know, this set off a trajectory for your career, right?
And I could never have been in the mafia with Jimmy Hoffa. Right. So, you know.
And we would have never met. And that would have been my loss.
And mine.
That's right. Any final thoughts on these years or what listeners out there might take from your experience?
I would encourage everybody to try and make a difference, not only in their own lives, but in other people's lives, because that's what people need right now. And, you know, I teach, I have 75 students this quarter. And, you know, a lot of my mentorship includes making them feel better, making them have hope and positive experiences. And I think collectively, our job is for everybody to sort of start doing that more, if you can. And I've never really left Hollywood, but I've devoted my life to inspiring young minds. So this podcast fits right into that philosophy.
And on behalf of everybody, thank you for your wisdom, your expertise, and your inspiration. Absolutely.
Well, let's go out and inspire people and do another one of these soon, John. It's always great talking to you.
Always great, Andy. Thank you so much for your stories. We always have a great time, and I'm looking forward to more.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Meyer Chronicles, and thank you for listening. To hear more episodes in this series, go to hotpiemedia.com.